This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
It is May 15, and in this episode, we are going to talk about the urban politics of the corona pandemic. After our first interview on March 12, we have invited our guests again.
Creighton Connolly, an urban geographer and political ecologist, senior lecturer at the University of Lincoln, UK. Harris Ali, a sociologist and professor at York University in Toronto. And Roger Keil, an urban researcher and professor at the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University in Toronto.
So, all of you, thank you for joining us. Thanks for taking your time again. My name is Markus Kipp, and I'm here with my colleague Ross Beveridge. Just to recapitulate what we have talked about in our last conversation, we learned from you about the role of interdisciplinary urban research for our understanding of the coronavirus outbreak. You pointed out lessons that some cities like Toronto, Singapore, and others have learned from the SARS epidemic in 2003 and how their implementation has affected today's preparedness. We also spoke about the racist framing of both the SARS and the coronavirus and the scapegoating of Asian populations for the outbreak. We also considered the role of the urban scale within the global architecture of public health responses and the dominant role of the nation state in structuring and deciding on the approach. And last but not least, you also highlighted several aspects and instances of solidarity responses emerging at local community level.
Yes, I mean, as Mark has said, a lot has happened since our last conversation in March. It seems like a good time to come back to you guys. To get us started, perhaps we could talk about your recently published journal article in Urban Studies, in which you link extended urbanization, the concept of extended urbanization, with spatialities of emerging infectious disease. Could you talk us through the main arguments of the paper?
Sure. So this paper starts with the premise that the expansion of cities along the urban periphery or the urban edge can actually lead to new forms of infectious disease, emerging infectious disease outbreaks, and particularly zoonoses, so diseases that cross the species barrier from animals into humans, which we know has been the case with the coronaviruses like SARS and MERS and now this new one. And this differs from previous research that has looked at both relationships between suburbanization and chronic disease, which had primarily been the focus with less on infectious disease, as well as research on urbanization and disease in general, including the research that Roger and Harris had done on SARS over the past 15 years or so. And one thing that we noted is that this potential vulnerability or emergence of infectious disease along the urban edge is related to changing social ecologies at the periphery of cities. And this has to do with the expansion of cities into formerly unurbanized areas, as I think Harris had talked about a bit in our last discussion. So in addition to that, we highlight three areas that we think that we need to pay attention to in future research for addressing this relationship between urbanization and infectious disease. And this is based on extensive literature review on these topics. So one is demographic change and mobility. So we're finding that we have large population increases on the urban edge through migration, rural to urban migration, particularly in the global south. And a lot of times you don't have the infrastructure doesn't necessarily keep pace with this growth of populations on the urban edge. And sometimes you have higher densities there as well, which can be problematic if there's a lack of sufficient infrastructure. So that brings me on to the next one, which is infrastructure and looking at the different ways in which transportation networks, manufacturing, transnational manufacturing networks, for example, can lead to infectious disease outbreaks. And the third one being governance issues. So you have sort of complex governance relationships in terms of responding to infectious disease outbreaks and preventing against possible outbreaks. And this often involves municipalities, regional governments like provincial, state, county governments, and obviously the national government as well, that has to be done in collaboration with health bodies. And I think we talked about this a little bit last time as well. But that's essentially the overview of the paper. And we talk about how we can use a spatialized or landscape political ecology approach to investigate these issues because of this, you know, the political highlighting of the political nature of disease outbreaks, as well as this spatialized aspect and the relationships between human and non-human natures and so on. So if Roger or Harris has anything to add, I'll allow them to do so.
I could just add that you make it sound like such a great paper. I want to read it myself.
That's great. I hope, I assume you also contributed to the paper, Roger, didn't you?
Yes, of course I contributed it, but it's good after, you know, this paper has had a long history and you, once it's out, it, you know, it becomes a different entity altogether. It has its own life. So my attempted joke was about basically the death of the author. The idea that the paper now has a life of its own that stands there now in on some journal's website, in Urban Studies' website, and you know, stares me in the face because I now need to live with the consequences of where this paper, with the afterlife of the paper. And here we have an actual in-life experiment of the fact that a paper is published right at the time when there seems to be an audience for it, and we as the writers of the paper, the authors of the paper, perhaps need to go back to it also and think about what it is that we have started here and what are the points that need to be taken forward in the conversation.
Going to one of the aspects of the paper, the last one you mentioned, Creighton, governance, could you give us an overview of the spectrum of different political responses to the COVID threat from Stockholm to Singapore? And what do you find remarkable about the differences or maybe even the similarities that you observe?
So I think there have been a sort of three types of responses, I suppose you could say, is one, you have governments that decided not to take a strong approach to, you know, imposing restrictions on movement. For example, early on in the disease, perhaps there wasn't the recognition of how serious it was. And then you have countries that acted very quickly right away. And then you have kind of a in-between approach. So last time we talked about how Singapore was one of those cases that actually took a very proactive approach at contact tracing and isolating and quarantining people. And this was quite effective for a while until last month when they had a big outbreak of coronavirus within their migrant worker dormitories, which are all located around the peripheries of the city, where people live in very dense quarters of about 12 to 20 people per room. So once this outbreak emerged, this was very much a blind spot for the government. There, you know, it wasn't certainly wasn't anticipated. Although, in hindsight, people have argued they should have seen this coming. But all of these workers, which are about 300,000 in total, had restrictions on the movements within their complexes. So a lot of them ended up feeling like they were actually in jail. And this sort of highlights the inequalities that you see this disease highlighting, in that you have two Singapores here, really, one for the citizens and long-term residents, expatriates, and so on, and then one for the low-wage migrant workers. So moving on to Hong Kong, I think, is another interesting example where actually the government didn't take a very firm response to the disease. Initially, the border with China wasn't closed until at least middle of February, when the outbreak there was quite advanced. There was lack of personal protection equipment as well. And there wasn't very, there was no emphasis on using masks. But what happened here, where you had these organizational infrastructures set up from the protests, where the protest groups actually took matters into their own hands and distributed masks to elderly people and installed hand sanitizers around the city, particularly in tenement blocks where you have high densities of low-income people. And one of the reasons for this is the memory of SARS that was really embedded in people's minds, because Hong Kong had one of the most serious outbreaks of SARS back in 2003. So I think this was a really interesting example of a grassroots response where the people were quite critical of their government's response and took things into their own hand. And this relates somewhat to Sweden's approach as well, which has also managed to largely avoid tough restrictions and closing down restaurants and bars and so on. This has been based largely on trusting people to act responsibly themselves, and has largely worked. I mean, there have been bans, of course, on sporting events and large groups of people and so on. But also there, the response has been led by scientists rather than politicians, which has been quite an effective strategy, which I think perhaps Roger can talk about a little bit more in the case of Germany.
I can just add that there has been a debate, of course, this about the relationship of science to politics all over the world. And the question is who drives what and what part of the debate makes the decisions. There is generally, I believe, two mega camps have emerged. One is a hyper-scientization of politics, which means that science speaks. The premier of the province of Ontario, who has not been known for being the most intellectual leader in the past, has now become a believer in science and speaks about the science driving things, and we will not open the economy of the province before the science tells him what to do. So there's this belief that science now regulates the way we conduct ourselves. But the opposite, of course, is also there. This has been a high time of populist fear-mongering and conspiracy theorists. COVIDiots are everywhere, and there is an attempt to derail any attempt at rational governing in any sense of the word. So I think we have both, and in each society, those types of reactions are currently being fought over, and it's not entirely clear how they're going to be decided or whether they ever are going to be decided. It clearly has given much more attention to both of those extremes, the science and the conspiracy, and any manner of interpretations in between. It is kind of ironic that Google Sidewalk Labs decamps out of Toronto just at the time when everybody talks about data and security and public health knowledge. It is interesting, perhaps this is just a real estate deal gone bad, but perhaps the securitization and surveillance agenda continues as it always has. It is a matter of mostly disciplining the poor, and this has always been the main agenda of those kinds of things that we now have to watch out for. We need to ask who's driving this agenda of data-driven smart city kind of development that is going to be with us now after the pandemic as it was before. Who has control over the data? Are there long-term controls? And those kinds of things mean quite different things to different people. Again, you know, they have a different impact on different populations. That is true, again, for those segregated neighborhoods in North America, but also to the banlieue in France or places like Sossenheim and Bonhamés in my hometown of Frankfurt, which, you know, where racialization is certainly part of the security regime and part of the way in which now data of all kinds and, you know, smart city development will be meted out to different people in different ways. And so maybe to conclude that particular observation, I want to quote Brandy Summers, who has written in the New York Times that Black folks have been educated in a kind of quarantine since day one. For a lot of us white folks, quarantine was the first time in their lives. The kind of sequestration that we have experienced is the first time in our lifetime, particularly if you're a middle-class person like myself. But for many other people in the world, this has always been part of city life. And this is something that we need to keep in mind as we, so quote unquote, normalize city life.
Just thinking more detail about the spectrum of responses, one of the key themes which has been cropping up has been density, of course. And we've talked about that on the podcast another time, a number of times, not least with Colin McFarlane. How could we characterize the debate around density and the different ways in which it's being presented and used in different contexts?
I listened to most of your interview with Colin McFarlane with a lot of interest, so I'll try not to repeat too much of what you talked about then. But I think, you know, as you mentioned, or as Colin mentioned, density has been accused for the severity of outbreaks in places like New York City. But also you have cities like Hong Kong, Seoul, and Taipei that are far denser, but also have fewer cases per capita. And so this is one reason why we've been suggesting that governance can actually be a more important factor than density in determining the severity of outbreaks. You also have social and cultural factors, like people in Asian cities tend to be more likely to wear masks in public than in the West, which can be a big preventative factor. But this is also, I think, creating a space for urban designers to think about how we might shift the design of cities and density in the future to sort of prevent or mitigate the severity of infectious disease outbreaks. So, for example, Lloyd Elter, who's an architect based in Toronto, argues about this Goldilocks density, where you have a density that is high enough, but not so high that people are living in 30-story apartment blocks and relying on extensive use of elevators and other sorts of public spaces. And also need to plan cities better to support bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. And this is something that I'm hearing quite a lot, so that people can get around with without relying on crowded public transit, like subways if needed, which Roger had referred me to a study that noted how the subway system in New York was actually a primary transmission mechanism for the disease in the city, as well as bus hubs and transit hubs on the outskirts of the city. Given the population and housing density of many informal settlements, there are also many opportunities for social mixing and limited options for physical and social distancing. So there's a global north-south difference here as well. So I think that's my main observations on that, unless Roger or Harris have anything else to add.
Yeah, let me just add a couple of things. I mean, like Creighton, I'm very impressed with the previous podcast you did with Colin McFarlane, which covered a lot of the points that needed to be made. In every city, we have now advocates of all kind that are urban intellectuals and city builders, like my friend and colleague Jay Pitter here in Toronto, who has written a wonderful piece in Azure magazine, which points out the dividing lines here in Toronto, specifically with a particular landscape that we have in Toronto, which is a city with 50% of people living in basically high-rise apartments also, and about 50% living in single-family homes, give or take. That in this city, of course, density means different things to different people, and we need to think about that all the time. Density isn't a problem in itself when it comes to infectious disease. It can actually be an advantage when it comes to fighting these outbreaks, like everything we know from the debate about compact cities more generally. The bundling of infrastructures and services can be quite a positive way to organize our lives. The problem with this entire debate on density has been, at least in cities like the one I live in here in North America, in Toronto, has been that many of those who have advocated higher density and compactness have proven to be condoning gentrification in mostly white and mostly upwardly mobile inner city neighborhoods. And though the same advocates have often shown little regard for the inner suburban massive housing areas that we have in many areas. Now, we have a lot of those here in Toronto, where there is overcrowding, bad physical maintenance, transit and food deserts, lack of park space, and so on. Automobile dependency happens in those kinds of neighborhoods. So talking about bicycle paths in dense inner cities is one thing, but talking about that in one of those massive suburban tower neighborhoods is quite a different thing. So their density can be turned into something really dangerous and debilitating for these poorer and more peripheral parts of town. And I think that's something we need to keep in mind as we speak about density. Density is not one thing, it is different things to different people.
Yeah, if I could just add one more thing to this discussion, is that I think both Roger and Creighton have highlighted this idea about the relationship between density and inequality. And I think that's one of the things that the pandemic has really opened up and allowed urban studies researchers to look into this relationship in more details. And I'll give just a couple more examples to illustrate what Roger and Creighton have just discussed. And one of the things is about, you know, high-rise buildings, condos, and the living there. You know, one critic once made the observation that this pandemic is, in a way, a middle-class quarantine phenomenon. You know, because many of the people who live in these high-rise buildings in Toronto, they're the very ones who can afford to do work remotely and stay at home. Right, they're not the ones who have to go out and conduct essential services, right? So there's an inequality there. Another inequality you can see in terms of controversies going on in Ontario now about cottage countries. You know, that you have wealthy cottagers who may live in downtown and other areas going up to the cottage areas where it's less dense. And the people who live in the cottage areas year-round saying, hey, we don't have the health infrastructure to accommodate an influx of people, right? So again, this illustrates a sort of inequality related to density.
Yes, so let's dwell on that point of inequality for a bit longer. As we have seen over the past weeks, the pandemic lays bare many of these inequalities in different societies, exacerbating some, producing new ones, and acknowledging the difficulty of speaking about race and gender in a cross-cultural context. What are your observations or what is your analysis in terms of how race and gender or other social divisions play out in the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think that we have to bear in mind, if you look back at the history of pandemics, is that there has always been this sort of scapegoating of people. Because the infectious disease is always sort of perceived to be coming from somewhere external, right? So there's always an othering process involved. And you see this throughout history in the various parts of the world. So even today, we see a different manifestation of that, the scapegoating and the xenophobia. So in a sense, it's not so surprising that this has come out once again, right? Because it almost always has. One of the differences, though, from the past is the role of the social media to spread xenophobic sentiments. And that, I think, has played a much greater role in inflaming this sort of racist sort of sentiments than in the past.
I can say a couple of things. One is, you know, having lived half of my life in Germany and having lived the other half in Canada, I realize that intuitively and in the way the state organizes itself, the recognition of inequality is quite different. You know, in North America, as opposed to much of Europe, people don't think in racial terms or even in ethnic terms. The state doesn't necessarily have good data on racial inequalities in many parts of Europe. There's even a divide between the United States and Canada in this respect. A lot of activists had to point out that as they're intuitively in the communities, people noticed that the victims of this particular pandemic tended to be in non-white communities, in poorer communities, and so on. There weren't good statistics in Canadian cities to actually prove that. While in the United States, in Chicago, Detroit, and New York City, it was obvious right from the beginning. So when we talk about recognition of these kinds of inequalities, it is important to look at how we normally look at our societies statistically. And that is, of course, it's a social scientific issue to some degree, but it's also one of how the state is organized and the administrations are organized, how public health sees cities, how public health sees its clientele, how it normally, without a pandemic present, subdivides populations, makes biopolitical distinctions between people. So that is something, and I'm not valuing or assessing this here as good or bad. I'm just pointing out that this is an issue in itself. The second thing is how cities are organized. You know, that many people understand that in the United States in particular, also to some degree in other parts of the world, you know, race can be read off the grid and the geography of a city. Segregation is a big issue in normal times. So, of course, segregation will also be an issue at times of a pandemic. So a more racially segregated city will have different outcomes in a pandemic and in terms of which parts of the population are affected than a non-segregated city. And those kinds of things need to be taken into account as we have a global conversation about that. And that doesn't even talk about possibly a third aspect that I don't want to get into, really, which is about the language we use to even understand those differences, and both in everyday life, but also in scholarly discourse.
Yeah, so I think as Roger and Harris have mentioned, you know, this isn't just a question of, you know, global north versus south. We also see inequalities within the global north as well. You have you know, in terms of the question about how, what are the urban logics of economic survival contradicting the state logics of lockdown. You know, you have 50% of people in Canada and the US that are unemployed now because of this. And you do have these debates about whether or not economies should open up in the US and Canada before they're actually ready. So, where I am now in British Columbia, has amongst the lowest growth in cases across the country, but you still have Ontario and Quebec, which have amongst the most that are starting to open up already. And you see the same thing in the US, where these political factors come in. But in large parts of the global south, where you have more informal economies, life does tend to go on, but people will simply make less money. So if you're selling something on the street, for example, you might still continue to do that, but you just might not have as many customers. But that can be a big issue, because many people in the informal economy or living in informal settlements tend to live hand to mouth with very limited savings or capacity to save. Whichever the sector, if it's formal or informal, anything that interferes with the demand for work or might have impacts on salaries or employment will have very disastrous impacts, because you don't have the same type of state that we have in the US or Canada that can provide subsidies or payments to people that are out of work. So this is something that I think needs to be addressed in the global south. So because the loss of income can have more disastrous effects in some cases and other related issues, like people being less able to purchase water and other essentials. So there needs to be some serious thought about that, and specific guidance for people who can't stop working as well, that provide essential services, for example. They should have protective equipment provided for those groups as well.
Thinking a little bit more about the responses to the crisis, and this idea that of Naomi Klein's, her famous book, The Shock Doctrine, that crises were an opportunity that could be instrumentalized take all proposals out of the drawer to achieve or further political agendas. How much are we witnessing that in the current context? And how much are we witnessing that to the extent of the detriment of democratic debate?
I think this is an excellent question, which is probably going to be with us for quite some time now that the societies are opening. The reordering and the reconfiguration of societies will be in that context. Let's not forget that Naomi Klein wrote this book during, I think, at the end of the Iraq War, and there's this famous scene, of course, when George Bush declares the war over. I think he's on an aircraft carrier somewhere and makes that declaration. Of course, all of us remember that. Then there were years of shock and awe that came after the war was over. So we have to be bracing ourselves for quite some time in which this reconfiguration of our global urban world will have to take place in quite a bit of an atmosphere of uncertainty. And now also, we need to admit that when this crisis started at the beginning of 2020, the world wasn't really in the hand of the good guys, right? So when we talk about applying the shock doctrine, then it is being applied, or has been applied, to countries and cities that have been suffering from austerity and neoliberalization for a while. In political terms, it's pretty obvious on everybody's mind that the United States has had a president from hell, and the United Kingdom has had a government of Brexiteers. The German conservatives are firmly in place, maybe not as firmly as their counterparts in the UK and the US, but the entire seeking of a successor of Merkel, who had once again built a big profile for herself nationally and internationally, but the successors are now trying to replace her, of course, are aligning their politics up vis-a-vis the kinds of possibilities that now exist in terms of applying some shock to society. So this is an interesting thing, and that even doesn't even mention the the usual suspects like Xi and Orban, Putin, Erdogan, Bolsonaro, those kinds of people who have been firmly in place in those kinds of societies with a more authoritarian or autocratic bent to them. So there is no liberal democracy there to be for the shock doctrine to be applied to. What is an outcome on the geopolitical level, which isn't really my scale of normal research, but it cannot be avoided to look at it, is of course we have this new constellation between China and the United States as the only remaining superpowers, and the WHO has become sort of like a football between them, in which both these superpowers are positioning themselves vis-a-vis the World Health Organization, the United Nations, or the world community more generally. And the shock doctrine idea fits very well here, because we will have to see what kind of shocks those superpowers have in store for us. Where I expect, beyond sort of the geopolitical, more in the terms of the global health governance, where I expect a huge impact of this current crisis is in the reordering of the global politics of public health, One Health. These kinds of issues will probably have to be debated again, and most specifically, the politics of vaccines. And you know, it is clear that right from the get-go, as this pandemic started, there was the question, when will the vaccine be ready? And there are now literally dozens, maybe hundreds of labs around the world working towards a manageable strategy for vaccine application. This is, of course, at a much larger scale than what we already saw over the last 3 to 5 years in West Africa and in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where also global pharmaceutical corporations have been in a race to create a vaccine, a working vaccine for the Ebola virus disease. That has now become a global search for a vaccine for COVID-19. And that is really sort of one place where I think that the kind of logic that Naomi Klein has been thinking about needs to be thought about. Perhaps I could add a couple of things. One is technopolitics, is what I would call the Elon Musk blueprints that are now being talked about. So when you talk about taking stuff out of drawers and applying them to democratic societies, Elon Musk is trying to outdo us all and taking a blueprint a day out of his drawers that he has somewhere in the California desert or in the Nevada desert, and is trying to remake the discourse, global discourse. And he's just one of those tech capitalists. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, but it's really important to keep our eyes on what kind of shocks can be expected from those particular drawers in the that are in the desks, if the non-existing desk of the tech industry. On that level, also, we need to think about how all of this relates to the climate emergency. That's probably a debate for another time, but we must not forget that this hit us at a time when many, many people around the world were beginning to see the light in terms of creating a global discourse on the climate emergency. So that would have to be taken up again at that high level. And lastly, perhaps, when we talk specifically about urban issues, urban planning, urban politics, here we have the questions largely right, reorganizing public space, densities, use of streets, availability of cycling infrastructure, and so on. And of course, there are little, tiny little shock doctrines now going on in those at that scale, at the urban scale, at which a lot of people now make a run for an end run for the kinds of things that they always thought was a good idea. Some of those local urban scale shocks are good things. It's great that some cities are now actually closing down streets for automobile traffic. Those kinds of things are very important, but they're also probably more evil kind of plans being brought out. And that has to be seen in a context of what my UBC colleague, Alex Flynn, has been talking about, which is the question of emergency powers for cities. So Many cities, like the city of Toronto, has given emergency powers to the mayor. He can currently decide on a lot of things that he normally doesn't have the power to. So he can apply little shocks to the democratic system as long as he has these emergency powers. And we need to watch very closely to what degree cities will ease out of this state of emergency and bring the democratic deliberation back into play. Thank you.
So let's take another look at the role of cities and regions and how their position in response to the pandemic has changed or not since the last time we spoke. I remember that you observed the dominant role for the nation state in this public health response. How has that changed over the past couple of weeks? And also, have we seen forms of collaboration among cities in view of a concerted or coordinated response?
I think there's three little things that could, short contributions I could make to this. One is that we are now having a debate whether, as during SARS, we talked about following, you know, the lead of David Fidler, who came to the conclusion that SARS was a post-Westphalian pathogen, and that which meant that it was something that opened up global health governance to forms of subnational and supranational governance that haven't been around really since the Peace of Westphalia and created the nation system. So we thought about SARS in that context of creating perhaps new pathways for these kinds of city-to-city politics. The books like Barbara's If Mayors Ruled the World, you know, was also in that same vein. The same David Fidler who came up with this has recently written a piece in which he says that COVID-19 is actually a Westphalian pathogen, and you know, the global governance has gone back to the scale of the nation state as an important one. Now, that is one way to look at it, and I think to some degree that is true. Others have pointed out, and much has to do with what Creighton already talked about in terms of Hong Kong and Singapore and Toronto, the experience of SARS, the city states, in particular Hong Kong, Singapore, but also others. But also those large global cities that are sort of oddities in their own countries. New York is an oddity in the United States. That those large cities have, of course, more weight to throw around in the global governance game. Now, that has already led to initiatives like the C40 Network of Cities, which has particularly been active in, again, climate emergency issues, has also now created a global mayor's COVID-19 recovery task force, which is coordinated by former Toronto mayor David Miller. That is kind of an example of how cities organize in a network fashion by themselves. What I want to point out, though, is that as these so-called global cities, these large cities that we all know the names of, are organizing themselves and with each other, a lot of the problems that we have seen under COVID-19 have actually occurred. A lot of, you know, the consequences of the outbreak have occurred in the lesser known places, in the smaller towns, in the peripheries of cities, in the peripheries of our urban world in which we live. And it's much less obvious in that context how cities have played a role, or communities or municipalities or regional outfits have played a role in organizing themselves in the larger scalar or federal architecture in which they normally operate. So that's something that we actually have now proposed just in a, you know, in a research proposal that some of us here in this podcast are part of, to think about that in a more global sense. We're proposing a study of 15 cities around the world that are quite different on all continents in the world, to actually look at how that has happened on the ground. I think it's too early to come to a conclusion here, but it is really important to keep our eyes on the forgotten forms of urbanity here and how they have been part of this collaborative effort amongst cities.
Drawing from our current experiences from such places as Singapore, Hong Kong, Monrovia, Toronto, what kind of lasting change from the corona pandemic should we expect in our urban health responses in view of reoccurring epidemics, influenza, or new ones?
Yeah, one of the things I think that will come up, and it's almost like a situation that occurred after 9/11, and this is the development of the securitization of society. You know, after 9/11, you know, in line with Naomi Klein's sort of arguments, you had the privatized security industry arising and dominating many spheres of social life. So, you know, you can talk about environmental security and energy security and national security, and all these different types of securities seem to dominate the discourse. By the same token, you can also talk about public health security. You know, and this is why certain political scientists became interested in this topic of public health, because it becomes redefined as a security issue. And it becomes a sort of political opportunity for the Defense Department to be involved and the security industries complex to be involved. And I think after the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, I think you will see much more of this sort of public health security discourses coming up. And this has implications more generally, because a certain aspect of the security emphasis is things like risk profiling or racial profiling and issues like that. And just as we've now become accustomed to greater searches or scrutiny at crossing the borders when we get onto the airplane, I think we will also be subject to more sort of public health security measures and more scrutiny. You know, what forms that will take is open to question, but that is a possibility.
It's quite clear that we're not just going to, you know, the pandemic isn't going to fade away and we'll just go back to the way we were before. I think there will be quite significant changes in society that really affect the way that that we travel and the way that we work. The way that the economy functions. So, you know, this is something that Roger and Harris had mentioned before from their SARS research, that there were some elements that came into play during SARS that kind of stuck around afterwards, particularly at the urban governance level and in terms of health policy as well. And of course, we saw that after 9/11 with the changes in the aviation industry. But I think we're going to have some more serious changes. And one thing that I was thinking about was that, you know, cities used to have quarantine spaces for people that, you know, were coming into the country, that they would spend 2 weeks in isolation somewhere and quarantine before they could go on with. And that's something that, you know, might become more regimented, because in the past, of course, infectious disease was a part of everyday life. It emerged all the time. And so it seems to be that we're kind of going back to this era where infectious disease is quite bound up with our everyday lives, and that these types of epidemics and pandemics will be occurring more frequently as our lives become more urbanized and globalized. So I think we will have some quite profound changes in that respect. I mean, I just wanted to add something in relation to the discussion around the shock doctrine, more at a global level. It's been interesting to see how China has been using the opportunity to some extent to advance their interests in Hong Kong and in the South China Sea. So there had been last month sort of arrest of about 14 politicians and activists in Hong Kong. And, you know, normally that would trigger huge waves of protests in Hong Kong. But of course, that wasn't able to happen at the time due to the pandemic. And I think a lot of these geopolitical interests have been advanced in the South China Sea and in, you know, flying military planes closer to Taiwan and really sort of taking advantage of the sort of distraction that the coronavirus has achieved. And, you know, I've been interested in doing research on this Belt and Road infrastructure that China is developing in Southeast Asia and Central Asia and parts of Africa. And one question I had was, is that going to stop now, or is that going to continue happening? And it's like, well, yes, actually, I think even more so. You know, the pandemic isn't going to be a reason for countries to shelve their geopolitical interests, but it can be quite the opposite in some cases as well.
In the countries in the global north, we might expect the pandemic to be over within a year or around a year. How long might we expect that? How long might these cycles take in the global south?
Yeah, that's actually a very difficult question to answer, because to some sense it depends on the biological characteristics of the virus. But even if the vaccine is developed, and it's a point that Roger alluded to previously, the question becomes one of vaccine distribution and the politics of vaccine distribution. And it's, you know, very likely, judging by the way the power inequality dynamics are today, that the global north will be receiving the vaccine first and that the global south will be receiving it second, right? So that means that the virus is embedded for a much longer period of time in the global south, at least over the lag time. So, you know, depending on the biological characteristics of the virus, you know, will the virus become endemic to that region, right? You know, will herd immunity be developed and then the virus just becomes an endemic sort of a phenomena? Again, it depends again on the biological constitution of the virus. That's one of the things that I think we have to look out for. And, you know, one of the lessons learned from infectious disease outbreaks in the past is viruses hide in the poor. Paul Farmer has written, you know, extensively about this in terms of structural violence. And you still, of course, see many examples of that, tuberculosis being the most prominent example. You know, and one of the other things that you have to bear in mind is that, you know, the Western positivist scientific informed approach to, you know, everything is to look at sort of the magic bullet. And in this case, or a technological fix, a technological solution. In this case, it's the vaccine. But again, if you look at, for example, the tuberculosis, the decline in the mortality rate in tuberculosis was occurring for decades before the antibiotic or vaccine was discovered. And why there was a decline in the mortality rate of tuberculosis was because of changing environmental and social conditions, having less crowded housing, having better nutrition, having better sanitary developments in the society, and so on and so forth, right? So it wasn't just the magic bullet of the vaccine or antibiotic that led to keeping the disease under control, but our environmental changes. And I think in the developing world, in the global south, there's always been this emphasis on sort of changing society and changing environment and not having to rely on a technological fix. And that's not, of course, to sort of downplay the importance of needing a vaccine. Of course, it's important. But I think in the neglected global south, they've had to almost be forced to find other ways of dealing with infectious diseases. And they have had a history of dealing with many types of infectious diseases over the past, and I think they'll continue to sort of use those sort of ways of dealing with infectious diseases instead of having to rely just on a vaccine, as we're so apt to do in the global north.
I did see a report in the Guardian just last night that's based on WHO data that says about 250 million people in Africa are expected to become infected with the coronavirus, and that only about 22% of these infections will occur in the next year, and perhaps up to 190,000 people dying in the next 2 months, and that this will, of course, overwhelm the medical capacity in much of Africa. So we are likely to see coronavirus lasting up to perhaps 4 years in Africa. As Harris was saying, you can have sort of the smoldering of the virus in certain hotspots, and you'll just have reoccurrences over time. So, you know, there could be second, third, fourth, fifth waves. Another factor that you might see, particularly in informal settlements, is that you can have a much sort of quicker peak with the number of infections. So, so you'll have more people becoming infected at the same time. So, yeah, these are really important issues that I think need to be addressed in Africa and other parts of the global south before, you know, health systems really get overburdened.
One of the things that I think everyone understands now, and may not have necessarily been the case in the past, is that a disease outbreak or pandemic is not simply a technical phenomena studied by scientists. You know, you have to look at the other aspects involved. I mean, even the term social distancing was used so much before, but it highlights the need to look at the social and the urban aspects of this very complex and emergent phenomena. And one of the things that we may have to deal with is sort of the issue of information overload, as you know, all the sort of disciplines sort of bring in their own insights into understanding and analyzing this phenomena, and it becomes a lot of work to sift through all this information, but at least we have that information.
Following up on that, against that backdrop, what kind of openings can we see then for progressive or even more transformative kinds of urban politics in, you know, given this context?
I think we need to differentiate through different kinds of politics. There's a politics of urban form, there's a politics on urban socioeconomic change, which addresses all these inequalities that we've been talking about. And there is a politics of urban governance and democracy. And I think in all of those areas, there are important new initiatives where people, despite the fact that we actually have no meaningful public space in which to go out into and to be in the streets and to make demands and those kinds of things that progressive urban movements have often been known for, there is an extremely high level of global conversation about those three discourses. I just want to mention one, which I think is extremely important and maybe the master discourse in all of those, which is the housing movement, movement about rent strikes and rent relief. Those kinds of things have been shown as being really hopeful. Now we need to make sure, this is the most important thing, we need to make sure that we're not being split into an urban movement and into an environmental movement, that we now bring together the loose ends of the climate emergency politics and the progressive urban politics in our cities worldwide.
Thank you very much, Creighton, Harris, and Roger, for this engaging conversation once again.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter